Hey, Alex, I've got a really good idea for a show.
What is it, Jack?
I think we should... Sorry, I think we should do a Batman show because it's the 15-year anniversary of Batman Begins.
Oh, yeah, that's a great idea.
That's good. Should we do it? Yeah, let's do it. Let's go.
All right, perfect. Batman Begins, The Dark Knight, and The Dark Knight Rises. Christopher Nolan's Batman trilogy. Let's go.
And now for our feature presentation... Tom Hanks Defense Force, with your hosts, Alex Halpern and Jack Fryer, a podcast for people who love film, television, and Tom Hanks.
Welcome back to Tom Hanks Defense Force. And as my wonderful cleared throat co-host just mentioned, we will be discussing the anniversary of Christopher Nolan's Batman trilogy. So yeah. That being Batman Begins, The Dark Knight, and The Dark Knight Rises.
And The Dark Knight, and don't forget the fall from The Dark Knight sits back down again because he forgot why he stood up.
It's just everything in succession is just like Christian Bale standing up and down again. Yeah, he's at his kid's birthday party playing musical chairs, trying to find a seat to rain dance or can or somewhere similar.
Yeah, it's just like imagine knocking with a child that would like get out of the way, just like I'm just like just pushing it.
Please. we have another special guest joining us on the show today. Kat, would you like to introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Kat. I'm Jack's girlfriend.
Yay!
Kat has been on... Sorry, after you.
We're celebrating our 14-month anniversary today by doing a podcast.
Hey! Happy 14-month anniversary, guys.
Thank you.
Yeah, what a beautiful way to be spending it. With me third-wheeling.
Always the way.
Kat has been on the podcast a few times, but it's always an absolute treat having her on, and she's always an amazing guest. So Kat, welcome back again.
Oh, you're nice on the bits that you're gonna edit out later.
Oh, amazing. Cool. So Jack, remind me, how like what anniversary is this of the Nolan's Batman trilogy?
So Batman Begins has been out for, in the UK, 15 years, a month, and 2 days.
Whew,
so that's an anniversary and a half to celebrate.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's strange to think how much the world has changed in general in those 15 years as well, excluding like the Batman trilogy in cinema. Just, you know, we've had so many different like prime ministers. Like we've had like five different prime ministers in the UK because Blair was PM when the first one came out. Then we had Gordon Brown was the prime minister when Dark Knight came out. David Cameron was the prime minister when Dark Knight Rises came out. We also had this is weird. Theresa May was prime minister when Suicide Squad came out and Justice League, which features Ben Affleck as Batman. And Boris Johnson, I think, was prime minister when The Joker came out, which features a young Batman. So we had like a different, apart excluding like the animated ones, we've had a different prime minister for each live action Batman, which is kind of weird.
Oh, interesting. And they're all Batman villains.
Because there's that, because Obama's rise to power is, again, because he became a senator in 2005, Batman Begins. First term in 2008, The Dark Knight. Second term, 2012, Dark Knight Rises. So
there we are. I mean, he's our Batman.
Yeah.
Like he's the Batman we need.
Different people have Doctor Who's, Obama's our Batman.
Yeah, we have Barack Obama. Oh, amazing. Oh, great. That's the thing, yeah, because I guess you know how in Old Boy he's imprisoned for 15 years in the original South Korean version. Yeah. So if he was imprisoned in early 2005 and then was released in 2020, that means
you have to go back in. He's in isolation.
Exactly. Yeah.
That, like, nope.
with all three films in the trilogy.
Yeah.
yeah, that's your entertainment for however long isolation continues to last.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because that's the thing, because they're very influential films, not only within the context of superhero films, in terms of inspiring future, well, the DC universe from that point onwards, from 2012 onwards, but also other thrillers, other action films, and they really, as a lot of critics would say, pioneered a new kind of class or a new standard for what the sort of dark, edgy, sort of mysterious, very motif-laden thrillers and other films that genre should look like.
Yeah, because what's his name? Sam Mendes said The Dark Knight influenced Skyfall, and it's had like an influence outside of superhero films as well. Because a lot of the Marvel films have been influenced by this. You know, Black Panther, the Marvel film, was influenced by the director Ryan Coogler said he took inspiration from The Dark Knight, and Michael B. Jordan, who played Killmonger in that film, said he took influence from Ledger's performance for his own portrayal. So it's had an influence not just in superhero films, but outside superhero films as well. And it's even been used in real life, because back to Obama, he explained the rise of Islamic State through The Dark Knight. He said, there's a scene in the beginning in which the gang leaders of Gotham are meeting. These are men who had the city divided up. They were thugs, but there was a kind of order. Everyone had his turf. And then the Joker comes in and lights the whole city on fire. ISIS is the Joker. It has the capacity to set the whole region on fire. That's why we have to fight it.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. Nolan never really held back from describing Bane and the League of Shadows as terrorists.
Yeah, of course.
In terms of their ambitions, their ultimate end goals, and their tactics. So, yeah, there's a lot of ways that, you know, for a sort of post-9/11 generation, that those films can be used as metaphors or ways of describing very current affairs.
Yeah, because it can be seen, there's like different ways of looking at it. Like some people saw like the extreme, because a writer called Andrew Clavin, who wrote in the Wall Street Journal, he compared the measures that Batman in The Dark Knight took to fight crime and voter George W. Bush in the War on Terror. And like a lot of people have seen it as like an anti-war film, because obviously a lot of people die because of Batman's actions, you know, for all good Batman's intentions are. Yeah, David. Sure. People get killed because of him. You know, David Goyer did say, he described the film as about escalation, and it's just about, you know, how we just they have to keep upping the ante to fight each other. And
yeah, definitely. And how they're both sort of working, you know, in parallel to each other. You know, their strengths and their weaknesses are growing alongside each other as they both become smarter and stronger. Particularly in The Dark Knight, you know, with the Joker being the obvious sort of antithesis to everything that Batman stands for. So it's really interesting in that sense.
Because it's just one of the things, it's just that, because the Joker says this line in the film, which in The Dark Knight, which does say, I can see you and I doing this forever, because Batman, obviously his main mantra is, I do not kill. He will never actually kill somebody. I'm sure he's got in the Batman Begins, he says to Ra's al Ghul, I'm not going to kill you, but I don't have to save you. He still, like, he won't kill anyone, because even the Joker, he saves the Joker's life when he falls out of the building. And because Joker's just, he sees, like, something in him that he needs, because in the comics, that relationship is very well documented, how they both need each other in a way. Like, Batman needs the Joker so he can carry on being the best, while the Joker needs Batman to keep pushing himself in his own way. So it's very much kind of a weird love-hate relationship in a way.
And they need each other. I mean, they thrive off each other.
Yeah.
Which is really interesting thing to analyze in the context of Gotham as a whole.
Yeah, of course, because you've got that in Dark Knight Rises, where like Batman retires, because when the Joker's not around anymore, he doesn't feel like, you know, corruption's kind of been defeated from the Gotham police force. Now Gordon's commissioner, so he decides he's just gonna stay in his mansion. He doesn't really need to be anymore, and he only comes out of retirement because Bane is such a threat to Gotham.
Yeah, and which they've even included in Todd Phillips's Joker, in the sense that, you know, it's really the riot and the sort of revolutionary movement, or whatever you want to call it, that Arthur Fleck starts, that does result in the death of the Waynes, of the Wayne parents. So it's, you know, it really goes to show how that, you know, that sort of that very careful duality between them, and how they both sort of play into each other's identities and who they both become, is very prevalent. And, you know, something that both, you know, Nolan and Phillips were very careful to portray.
Yeah, because interesting, because I think I don't remember history, but I know The Dark Knight did come out around the time of the Wall Street, not the Wall Street crash, but the financial crisis.
The financial
crash in 2000. Yeah, that was around 2008, 2009.
Yeah.
A lot of people draw a lot of parallels between the Joker and that.
But it's an interesting thing because Bane actually makes a cameo in The Big Short. Sorry, you were saying?
Big Short, though.
Oh, there we are. Perfect.
There
that Easter egg that nobody knew they wanted. Well, it's not even Easter egg at all. It's just us chatting shit.
One thing I did find interesting about Batman Begins is just how it was just completely different, because we had 8 years before that was Batman and Robin, and that was just ridiculously camp. It was like Arnold Schwarzenegger and Uma Thurman in big costumes dropping cheesy one-liners like, you know what killed the dinosaurs? The Ice Age. And things like that, which Joel Schumacher actually publicly apologised for making that film later. And George Clooney still apologises to it this day. In interviews, if it's brought up, he apologises for that film.
But that's an interesting thing, because remind me when the last one of those films came out?
97,
sure.
Because that's 5 years. So 8 years.
Yeah. I guess that's the thing, because you can tell that Nolan's films are very much influenced by Michael Mann's thrillers.
Yeah.
In terms of these very, heavily stylized, very sleek crime thrillers, but on an almost blockbustery scale.
Yeah, of course.
And, one could argue that before Batman Begins, there was very little, very little obligation or very little sort of, yeah, I mean, there were very few ideas that crossing, an iconic superhero film with another, completely non-superhero related genre, would set a whole new standard. So in that sense, it's almost like Joel Schumacher is still making a film along the standards of what Batman has for the most part always been portrayed as, which is Batman clad in tights and with Robin, and it's all quite camp. Was farcical, like you were saying.
Yeah, he's got in Batman and Robin, there's the bat nipples and there's the bat credit card, which he uses to pay for things. It's like you've got your surely they would trace the funds ago. It's Bruce Wayne all along.
Is it? I mean, not in the bat card. I mean, that's more secure than PayPal. it sort of goes to show that, by Chris Nolan jumping into another genre and taking the sort of standard of style and applying it to the superhero genre, that just set a whole new precedent for how, Batman could be, could tackle serious themes, and it would be genuinely, deeper and more layered and, just more visually, visually modern and stunning.
Yeah, I'd agree with that, because I remember us being of the age watching all this stuff as it was coming out, and that was the first time I felt, wait, superheroes can be more of an adult film, not something you'd watch on a Saturday morning.
Because
I felt like, I think Christopher Nolan, in a way, because obviously before that, his biggest films were Insomnia and Memento, and he was hired in January 2003, so it took about two and a half years to go from development to things. He worked on it with David S. Goyer. It was just because Nolan wanted to reinvent the character, and he wanted to do it by grounding in reality and not having it in a world where other heroes didn't exist. Because he was influenced by the Richard Donner's Superman film, the 1978 one, but I think grounding in reality was actually quite a smart move, because in a way it would seem a bit for this universe it would be a bit unrealistic, I think, to have Superman just fly by or something.
Sorry, Kat, were you about to say something?
No, I was just agreeing.
Sure. I guess, and that's the thing. I guess that is what DC later tried to do with their sort of incorporated, expanded universe.
Yeah.
But, yeah, you're right. And it's, even though Joseph Gordon-Levitt is essentially Robin, or at least is heavily implied to be Robin, it's, you can tell that he never felt, Nolan never felt the need to make him more than just the sort of semi-minor character that he was.
Yeah, because, the thing is, obviously, because there's no actual Robin actually called Robin, though, which is why a lot of people found that character. Because, the main Robin, his real name's Dick Grayson. There's been, so many different Robins who've taken on different identities over the years. But it's just, it does, I can understand, in a way, why some Batman fans were angry that he was called Robin, but it's such a throwaway gag at the end of the film. I think it's something too small to be annoyed about.
Yeah, exactly. And it's sort of, it's a little thing for the fans. It's harmless, really.
It is. I would have liked to have seen like a sequel where it's just it's Joseph Gordon-Levitt carrying on as Batman, because there were actual discussions around that, but DC decided to scrap it in the end. Also, because they were so keen to like get that integrated universe, because you know DC like they wanted Nolan to finish the trilogy. Nolan did, but he wanted to do it between films, because I read an interview, I remember a few years ago, where he didn't necessarily want to do a sequel, but while making The Prestige, that Joker card just kept popping into his head. And he said to Warner Brothers, look, I'll do it, but on the condition I get to do the Joker how I want to do it. And they're like, well, sure. So, yeah
great. And
it's just, I think it's just testament to, like, the fact that they, how much they respect Nolan, the fact they, and how much, like, they're saying, yeah, we'll do it. That's what, if that's what it takes to bring you back, sure.
Yeah, exactly. And one day there will be an actual Joker who's called Joker. Like, not Jack not Jack Napier or Arthur Fleck.
Yeah. Because, you know, the Integrated Universe thing, because Christian Bale was actually allegedly offered $50 million to come back as Batman for Batman versus Superman. Ooh. But yeah, he turned it down because he didn't want to do it without Christopher Nolan. Also, he was kind of done playing the character. But yeah, like, also, it would have been problematic as well, because it would have taken away, I think, something from the previous films. If it was suddenly, oh, this is the Southern Universe as well, then...
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's... I'm sure even Warner Bros. Wanted people to... You know, even you know, despite making that payment offer, you know, I'm sure afterwards there was some reflection that actually, you know, maybe we should keep our expanded universe as separate from Nolan's world, because... Yeah. That just, you know, deprives the charm and the individuality of it.
Well, now that DC are going down the multiverse road, maybe we will see a return to that universe. Because if Michael Keaton's going to come back as an old Batman in the Flash film, maybe we'll see Christian Bale put on the Batsuit as like a mentor figure one last time, or Joseph Gordon-Levitt pops up as Batman as the new Batman. Maybe we could see that happening.
It's a possibility. Hopefully we'll see Arnold Schwarzenegger return as Mr. Freeze again as well. With his ridiculous, like, atrocious puns. Oh, amazing.
Because I find it interesting, though, in a way that how big the profit jumps were from the films, because The Batman Begins only made $373 million on a $150 million budget, but then the next two both made $1 billion. I think a lot of that was down due to the incredible... Because one of the first film, The Dark Knight's marketing campaigns, one of the first campaigns to really embrace viral marketing.
It was, that's very true.
Because some of it, so there was like different websites and clues all going around the internet with Easter eggs. And if you unlocked it, you got to unlock a trailer. And even it ended with like projections onto actual skyscrapers, which was, and like leaving people, they actually had to go out into the world to find things, which I thought was incredibly ahead of its time, I think.
Oh, definitely, yeah. And I guess you saw similar kind of marketing approaches with things like District 9. Yes. I think one of the Resident Evil films did something similar. But this was, you know, for a superhero film, a big, you know, studio blockbuster, you know, for a very well-recognized, well, universally known, like a household name franchise. So, yeah, and I think, a part of it was also due to the... you know, the tragic and untimely death of Heath Ledger.
Of course.
You know, for his outstanding performance. And also a lot of the the press attention towards sort of the reasons for his death. His, you know, his sort of his final sort of few weeks and days. And obviously everybody did approach it with the respect that was needed.
Of course.
But I think that did also play a factor in,
undoubtedly. Because Heath Ledger was seen as a very promising up-and-coming actor, and he was also a very young Joker as well. Like, he was in his mid-20s when he played the role, and he died only aged 28, and so I think that shock in a way did, I think, give the film a lot more press, whether it was good press or bad press. It definitely. You know, a lot. It was surrounded the whole press tour, which in a way I think it was a bit sad though, seeing all the actors being asked about it all the time for every interview. It must have been like quite a strain on them, I guess.
Sure, I mean, yeah, understandably, but I guess, you know, when an actor or someone that, you know, someone they've worked so closely with does pass away so suddenly like that, it's going to attract a lot of attention for a whole plethora of reasons. But even then, like from a technical perspective, it was appraised across the board. I mean, it was nominated for 8 Oscars, wasn't it?
Yes, it was nominated. Yeah, 8 Oscars. It won obviously for Ledger and Best Sound Editing as well.
Whereas Batman Begins was only nominated for Best Cinematography, wasn't it?
I think so, yes.
I believe so, yeah.
I think it was quite... a lot of people were very shocked that a superhero film actually won Oscars, like, for an acting category, which was quite groundbreaking. Like, we haven't really seen anything since then, apart from Joaquin Phoenix, but, you know, 2 actors win it for The Joker, which I guess, quoting out The Joker, is kind of one of the... It's kind of in a way like the Hamlet, one of our Hamlets of our generation, I guess, if that makes sense. It's like a iconic role that everyone kind of wants to go for, or at least have a go at.
Yeah, and I guess it's the mystery behind the madness, which everyone's, you know, actors who enjoy playing those roles are consistently very curious to try and figure out. You know, given the Joker is perpetually wrapped in this mystery, you know, it's that mystery that defines him, that defines his madness, but... You know, I guess anyone who plays it, you know, whether that's, Joaquin Phoenix or even Jared Leto or whoever will, you know, always be very interested in, you know, what made the Joker who he is in the first place. So I imagine when Joaquin Phoenix was approached to play Arthur Fleck, you know, there was a lot of very serious emotional investment into the reasons why Arthur Fleck became the Joker. And to really study and become a part of that journey.
Because there is the argument, though, if a Joker wasn't about the Joker and it was just like a film about any other character, it wouldn't have done as well, because obviously the weight of the name of that character.
And the topics and the themes that it wrestled with.
Yeah, of course.
And which I think it did very well, and I think a lot of other critics seem to think so.
I know, and I feel like, given the impact of that iconic performance in The Dark Knight, I think a lot of people went into Joker thinking, would it compare to Heath Ledger? It was on a lot of people's minds, even though it's a very different Joker.
Yeah, definitely. But I guess, you know, people didn't know what to expect from Ledger's Joker at all.
Oh, yeah.
Even with the viral marketing, like you were saying, that was, for the most part, shrouded in mystery. And, yeah, I guess. I mean, it's sort of like, you know, which had the more iconic viral marketing, The Dark Knight or Paranormal Activity.
Yeah. Because I look back on like those films, we watched The Dark Knight just before Joker came out with Jack Nicholson Joker, just so I could get those forms in my head when I saw it, just so I could kind of compare them.
Oh, interesting.
Because each Joker is very different. Like Cesar Romero is just a clown, basically. Jack Nicholson's like a traditional kind of mobster. Heath Ledger's an anarchist. Jared Leto is more like a gangster in a way, how you can call him that. And obviously Joaquin Phoenix is just like, he's kind of a failed comedian, I see, out of the portrayals.
Yeah, he's more of the everyman.
Yeah,
which I guess is what he was partially designed to be.
Yeah.
That must have been really fascinating to really compare the evolution and how, you know, what audiences expect from a Joker as well. Like, what sort of new nuances do they expect to be brought to that performance? And any additions to the backstory. I guess jumping topic a little bit, partially because versions of the Joker have become increasingly dark and have tackled more universal and more modern themes in recent years, particularly with Joaquin Phoenix's Arthur Fleck. But, you know, I mean, DC and Warner Brothers' approach to their superheroes has become increasingly dark since the Nolan trilogy.
Exactly.
So do you think, I guess we'll see so much more with Robert Pattinson's Batman.
Yeah, of course.
But do you think that will just be the standard from now on, that DC superheroes are just, you know, more dark, more mysterious, more sort of moodily stylized? Do you think that will be the standard from now on?
I'd say yeah. I say, so it was the first one that hit me as a serious superhero film, and like I say, everything that's gone from there, Nolan set the tone for how DC can really, really stand out in cinema. that rather than just being, oh, it's another superhero film, Marvel's definitely taking over the niche for their superhero, but adventure, bit of action, throw in some wacky one-lines, while DC, they really are sort of aiming more down the sort of, oh, it's serious, it's got some really important undertones, oh, and here's a building falling over.
Yeah, very true.
It's, I find it interesting because, in a way, The Dark Knight has been criticised because it's, in a way, well, not The Dark Knight, but there's been a lot of criticism of superhero films that are trying to mimic The Dark Knight. Like, people felt that Henry Cavill's Man of Steel was too dark, and they felt Batman vs. Superman was too needlessly dark as well, because obviously they felt the tone was mismatched, because Superman is meant to be uncomfortable in Batman's world, because Superman's all about optimism, while Batman is a pessimist at the end of the day, which in a way, they kind of balance each other out in a way, which is why their two relationship is good in a way, but when it's just the two of them. But I think, in a way, The Dark Knight, a lot of people, because a lot of criticism of some superhero films is, or just films in general, is that they go for the tone without the intelligence or gravitas which Nolan had, which made why the tone worked, that one. And because I remember there was actual controversy around The Dark Knight when it came out, because there was lots of parent groups just saying this film shouldn't be a 12A. Even my dad, because he saw the Jack Nicholson Batman in the cinema, well, that's still rated 15, but The Dark Knight's a 12A. And my dad was like, well, how is that a 15? This is a 12A. It should be the other way around.
Yeah, like, I mean, the pencil scene.
Yeah, the pencil scene was one thing in particular. That's one scene. And there's also the other scene, just, you know, how do I get these scars, all that. And,
yeah,
you know,
the
there's lots of they're like really like horrifying moments when you come to think of it. And it was on the front cover of a newspaper, I think. It was definitely all in the first few pages. And I could definitely understand why there was outrage. I don't do the ratings, but in a way, I do feel that The Dark Knight, in a way, is one of the greatest superhero films of all time. I think it's a lot of films, it's going to take something very special to kind of at least get on par with it in terms of Batman films. But it does the rare thing, it's a sequel that doesn't, in a way, feel like a sequel. It feels like its own kind of standalone in its own terms.
Yeah. Well, I guess it wasn't originally meant to be a trilogy, was it? You know, like you were saying earlier, it was, you know, Nolan didn't initially want to do a third film. You know, it was really after being persuaded that it would, you know, like, it would, yeah, a third film would be a great way to create some genuine closure and, you know, several other factors that actually brought him round to it.
Because he wanted to do Inception. He said he would think, when he came around to it, he was like, I'll do it, but I want to do Inception first. Which is 10 years old this year as well, another anniversary.
There we go.
I know, but it's the way, like, because there were some, I think, so I read an interview with one of the crew, and they said they did have plans for a sequel where Heath Ledger's Joker came back, but it was that obviously it had to change if they didn't want to recast. So I think, but I do like The Dark Knight Rises, because I remember the hype, though, when that film came out, though, was in a way too much, because...
It was huge. I heard rumours that it was going to be 4 hours long. Originally.
Yeah, there was rumours it was going to be 4 hours long. It was going to be split into two films, but that obviously that all didn't turn out to be true. But it was 2 hours 45. And, you know, a lot of people were quite curious, to say the least, about that, about how long it was going to be. But then you had Endgame, which came out last year, and that was like 3 hours long. You know, and people asking cinemas to go for like have a toilet break installed in the film so they can go. Just go before you see the film.
Exactly, yeah, and just, you know, be tactical about it.
Yeah, like don't drink a litre of Lucozade before seeing the film.
Yeah, particularly if you have a weak bladder, then there's going to be concerns.
No, it's just the thing is, though, like The Dark Knight Rises, though, for me, I think that is the weakest of the trilogy.
I mean, I really enjoyed The Dark Knight Rises.
Of course, no, I enjoyed it.
Sure, I think, I mean, do you think it was the weakest, like, thematically, or in terms of plot detail, or, like, why do you think it was the worst?
It's hard to say, because I know the hype had been going for a year, because the first trailer for it did come out with the final Harry Potter film attached to it, and it wasn't even on the internet, it was just at the film. So you had this hype for it for a year before it was released, and in a way, maybe the hype for trailer was released too early, maybe. But I think there was such expectation, like a 4-year wait since the previous Dark Knight, there was a lot of will they or won't they top it, and I think the hype in a way kind of ruined it. Not so to speak, but and I think I did really like it. I still think it's a very good film. Theme wise, I think a lot of the Bane themes of anarchy and like taking back power, I think a lot of them I still think in a way are relevant today in some way. But I don't think I connected with it as much as the previous two. So I like the fact in Batman Begins it's like an actual proper origin story, and we get to see and we grow with Bruce Wayne, and we see him from the first film become Batman. We see Gordon grow as well. But it's just I feel in a way I think it had too much to live up to after The Dark Knight. In a way.
Yeah, and I guess that was always going to be the concern, wasn't it? That it would just be either, you know, trying to replicate The Dark Knight too much, or wouldn't quite meet the expected standard to beat it. I don't know, I think I was impressed how they kept on upping the scale.
No, of course, they got that right.
Yeah, and I guess after, you know, the opening of The Dark Knight, that really impressive bank heist scene.
Yeah.
It's, you know, everyone's wondering how are they going to pull off a more impressive opener. You know, will there be another like heist or theft scene, but on a bigger scale? Will there be some other like elaborate plan that's pulled off and it lasts longer? You know, it goes on for like, I don't know, 15 minutes or so. There's a lot of discussion around what that would look like.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think they did pull it off with the CIA plane abduction scene.
Good, yeah.
I think the sort of the scale with the sort of the kind of not the blueprint, what's the right term for it? The so the nuclear the nuclear core that was stolen from Wayne Enterprises. I think that naturally ups the scale of the potential devastation, you know, which could turn it into a sort of disaster movie of sorts. But yeah, it was. I don't know. I think they did like. Pull it off pretty well.
Do you dive The Dark Knight Rises?
I like it, because when you said about it being, in your opinion, the weakest, for me, weirdly, I actually find Batman Begins the weakest of the three.
Oh, interesting.
But I don't know if it's because I saw it out of order. So I saw Dark Knight first as a standalone film, just experienced it as it was, and then Dark Knight Rises was a sequel, and then I was like, oh yeah, there's one that was first, okay, and then watched it third.
Okay.
So watching it in that sort of weird thrown out order, it didn't have the same impact as like building this character up and then seeing where he goes. It's more like, this is an amazing character, and then there's some good bits here, but it definitely progressed in the later two. I do feel Dark Knight's of course the best one.
Yeah, I think that's the best one.
Rises has some really great themes. I did love that they actually had Bane, because so many times he gets written as either intelligent or strong. Well, it was really nice to actually see a live-action portrayal of him, and he is a proper supervillain. He's meant to be good at all of that. It's not an either-or between brains and brawn.
Yeah, I'm glad it wasn't. They didn't have like him stuck to all these big tubes of venom where he becomes like just super-sized and all that.
Yeah, and he sort of speaks like a Neanderthal.
Yeah.
He's this mindless thug, like in Schumacher's version.
Yeah, and I can see some, because like the film did come out, and like, a lot of people saw it as like anti-Occupy Wall Street in a way, but some people saw it as pro-Occupy Wall Street in a way, about how we need to take down the upper classes and truly have the power back to the people. But my favourite interpretation is by Rush Limbaugh, who said the film was against Mitt Romney due to Bane's name being a homophone for Bane Capital, the company Mitt Romney used to head, which I thought, when Chris Owner even said in an interview, this is bizarre, there's literally no weight behind this.
I mean, was that in one of those sort of like variety videos where they call in these filmmakers or these artists to sort of, you know, sort of discuss these theories?
Yeah, I don't know, because Slavoj Žižek was asked his opinion as well, and he argued the film was inspired by the French Revolution as portrayed by Charles Dickens. Some people even compared it to Les Mis, weirdly. I don't know where that came from, but
I mean, sure, there are elements, as with most modern revolution stories. But yeah, and I guess And I guess it's that, you know, that really consistently grey, kind of sort of murky, moody colour palette that persists throughout all three films that really helps with that.
Yeah.
You know, strong, like, shades of grey throughout, you know, all the sort of, you know, climactic scenes in The Dark Knight Rises. You know, and The Dark Knight, well, and all of them, that really sort of adds that tone of, like, you know, it's almost like we're seeing it through the lens of a historical film.
Yeah.
And that is something that I did really like with sort of them. It's also the only time you ever really get bright colours is when it's the almost aristocratic balls. Like when they have their big dinners, then you get the reds and the golds for a little bit.
Yeah.
Still slightly toned down, but the outside world is so dark. And then that's why you really appreciate the revolution in the third one. And you see, actually, you know, drag it all down to this, bring out the true nature of Gotham rather than the little pretense.
That's a very good point. And I guess at the end of it all as well, so particularly at the end of The Dark Knight Rises, when God, why is his name slipped from my mind? This is so bad. Michael Caine.
Oh yeah. Alfred.
Alfred, that's it. Sorry, I just lost his name for a moment. When Alfred sees Bruce Wayne and Selina Kyle. The cafe at the end, yeah. And yeah, and that has, you know, has red wine and it has the bright beige you know, blazers, and you know, you see like proper, like genuine sunlight almost for the first time in about, you know, what's almost 2.5 hours. And yeah, I guess, you know, like, I guess sort of, you know, little moments like that really emphasize this, you know, significant change in emotion, this breath of fresh air, but also new beginnings.
Yeah, because I know some people, Batman fans, were angry with that because they thought, well, Batman wouldn't retire. He would never give up. He would just keep going. And also because the film was influenced by the Dark Knight Returns films, where 55-year-old Bruce Wayne can't just comes out of retirement because Gotham's in such a state. And they thought, well, Batman would never retire. He would just keep going. And even when he can't keep going, he would still be a tactician against war on crime. And they didn't like the idea that he would actually just find peace and let a protege take over.
But do you think you can put a monopoly on what Batman is supposed to be like as a character?
Well, no, you can't, because I think it's up to each creator and director to give their own interpretation of a camera. You know, like, we've had hundreds of different interpretations of Hamlet since Shakespeare wrote it, you know, and I think the same in a way does apply to, you know, films nowadays, because I know no one really kicks off when Hamlet's put on in the West End for like the 10th time, well, 100th time, whatever. Whereas like a remake of a film, like, oh,
speak for yourself. I mean, like, I'm out there every Friday night, placard in hand. that's a really good point. Sorry, Kat, were you about to say something?
No, I'm just laughing at picturing you just like protesting every time a West End show gets recast, like twice a year, just here, like, no, Les Mis, you are one, we can only have one actor for Valjean.
Bring back Kevin R. McNally. Yeah, I guess, maybe one day when my sort of frustrations towards a particular West End show suddenly boils to breaking point.
It's like throwing a chair through the screening of a Les Mis, like, throw it onto stage, like, ah!
When they bring out Fast Trap again.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. I mean, a modern take on Mousetrap or any sort of, I guess, non-traditional setting for any Agatha Christie play would be really interesting.
Yeah.
Just imagine some sort of like steampunk or industrial, like, or cyberpunk adaptation of, yeah, the Mousetrap. Or,
oh mate, like, I want a modern day Poirot where he carries a shotgun. It's called Agatha, and like little tribute to Agatha Christie. Or like Miss, because they was an adaptation a few years ago. They were planning to reboot Miss Marple for an American audience with Jennifer Garner as Miss Marple. They were saying she's too young, and people, there's a lot of backlash from like hardcore Christie fans, like actively kicking off on social media about it. They're saying she's not the right age. They're trying to sex Miss Marple off or something. And it was amusing watching all these people just kick off about Agatha Christie. I was like, wow, this is nothing I ever saw. Kicking off at Star Wars, Marvel, DC, yeah, but Agatha Christie, I never ever caught my mind that could happen.
Yeah, there'll be a film in the future where, like, Miss Marple is one of Charlie's Angels. But that was a really interesting point that you had before about how it is the responsibility, or rather solely the responsibility of the creator, to basically dream up and own their reimagining and be able to, you know, maybe even to be able to explain their reimagining. And not that, you know, any creator can explain every single detail of their characters, because that would just take out, you know, the nuance and, you know, the enjoyment of just imagining what lies beyond the surface of their character. But, you know, it's like, you know, even superheroes should have that creative license to differ at times and to, you know, incorporate elements that are part of like a modern context, or, you know, maybe even a, you know, reimagined setting.
Yeah.
So I agree, there should be, that flexibility should be allowed.
Well, there's been a lot of people have argued that they're superheroes, you know, like Iron Man, Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman, Spider-Man, Thor, Captain America, Hulk, etc. They're like the modern day Greek pantheon of gods to us. And like even Mark Ruffalo, you know, who's the current Hulk, described playing Bruce Banner as a modern day Hamlet, and he said about a role that's passed down from generation to generation. So I think in a way it's interesting to see all these different interpretations on screen. Like, we've got different Batmans appearing on screen, we've got different Batmans on film, you obviously got all the different comics about Batman and these different multiverses. So in a way I do like the idea there's different actors always portraying these characters and each giving their own little take. So for us as an audience, we get to experience different things, because Robert Pattinson's Batman's going to be its own contained universe. So I think that's going to be interesting to see what he brings to the role as like a younger, slightly younger Bruce Wayne. Also with Andy Serkis Alfred, you've got a slightly younger Alfred as well. So I think interesting like portrayal of that coming to screen as well. So I think it'd be interesting to see who's going to play what Matt Reeves is going to bring, because obviously Matt Reeves directed Dawn and War of the Planet of the Apes, you know, two of the greatest films of the last decade, I'd argue. And I think it's really, I'm excited to see what they're going to bring to the role.
Yeah, definitely. But and I guess like Kat, you had a really good point earlier about about how, you know, Nolan redefined what Batman should look like. So it's, you know, it is more serious, and it's not something that, like you said, you'd expect to see on, you know, as a Saturday morning cartoon. But then, like Jack, how you were saying how it's great that Batman does still have all these different variations and different reimaginings. But do you think if a number of those like different more wacky reimaginings were made for the silver screen, like were made to be more serious adaptations, do you think they would work in that sort of that modern Nolan style?
Like, I don't think, because it's interesting, because like, I don't think Adam West Batman obviously could work today. You know, it's the 60s is over. like, it's still going on, and there's still like there was an animated series, two animated films based on the Adam West style that was like straight to DVD. And like, there's still a Batman 66 comic going on for like people who are still very nostalgic about that. I think Nolan's version could work today. I think if Dark Knight came out today, I think it would be very interesting. I think it'd be interesting to see how audiences perceive it now. It's already described as a modern classic, which makes me a bit terrified, because in 20 years' time, it'll be described as a golden oldie.
Classic.
No, but I think Dark Knight, if it came out today, would still be great. It would still be greatly received. But I do think that Batman will always have a place. There's always going to be a demand for Batman, because he is one of the greatest comic creations of all time. Definitely.
Yeah, definitely. Do you think, I mean, I guess obviously this is, you know, one of the impossible questions, but do you think there'll really be another, you know, not just Batman adaptation, but any other superhero adaptation that could even be better than the Nolan's trilogy? I mean, these are, you know, Nolan's trilogy is seen as one of the best superhero adaptations ever.
Yeah, it's not even seen as one of the best superhero adaptations, but it's also...
Exactly, yeah, it's near the top of pretty much everyone's list.
The Dark Knight is considered by critics and fans alike to be one of the best films of the decade, full stop.
Yeah.
I think it's going to be very interesting to see who... what will happen, because I think... I don't know if anything can top it, because Firstly, my favourite superhero film of all time is Logan, but I think in a way that is so good because we did have all hands 17 years of Hugh Jackman and leading up to his final film. And I think in a way that, because I watched the first X-Men film in like VHS, rented it from Blockbuster.
Yeah.
And, you know, and seeing it find the journey end on the big screen was so emotional. I think because of the time we spent with that character,
I remember being 11 years old on my German exchange program and snuggling up at night with my little PSP watching the first X-Men film.
Wow.
And it's weird all these years later, sort of having that closure. I mean, also, I feel like in an alternate reality, this podcast is called Hugh Jackman Defense Force. I feel like he's on very similar levels of, of just lovability with Tom Hanks, totally, in my personal opinion.
Oh, I'm with that. I went to see him live when he did a show in London. It was absolutely amazing.
Ah, amazing. what show was that?
Oh, it was just Hugh Jackman. It was just he did a sort of like all different referencing different songs and musical he's done. And,
it was mainly a Greatest Showman tour, wasn't it?
No, it wasn't just Greatest Showman. Like, he started as a song and dance man doing Oklahoma back on like Hey Mr. Producer days.
Oh, okay.
And it was just going through like his years and years of career. He did do, of course, Wolverine references once or twice.
Oh, that's nice.
He was very happy to get to do some Panto references. He played Gaston, Beauty and the Beast, for a while.
Oh, okay.
Nice. On stage. And yeah, it was just a reference and homage to different things he's done. More theatre than film, but still some wonderful little bits in there.
Yeah, definitely. Oh, he's the dream.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If we can attain any of the heights that Hugh Jackman has achieved just as a person, then we know we've done well.
Well, Hugh Jackman was actually linked to play Batman when Christian Bale stepped down, but he didn't. Obviously, it went to Ben Affleck, and I think I love to have seen Hugh Jackman's take on Batman.
Yeah, because he, age wise, if we're sticking to you're not so young Batman, then yeah, he would have done well. He's got the physique. We've seen through Wolverine, he can have that roguish mystery to him as well. I think he would have done a really good job.
Yeah, he's definitely got the suave and charm like Bruce Wayne. You can see him like winking at like a group of models, they just fall over and just
while saying, "Oh, Hugh Jackman." I think, yeah. I mean, Kat, who would you like to see as Batman in the future, other than Hugh Jackman?
That's an impossible question. I'm interested to see where Pattinson takes it, but I don't know if it's one of the bits. I've got so used to the Nolan trilogy.
Christian Bale.
I'm looking forward to, I can't remember the actor you said, who's doing the Dark Knight Returns, the older versions.
Oh,
Michael Keaton. Like, I'm looking forward to how he comes back out. I do love the versions of older Batman.
Yeah.
But it's one of those things I don't know quite where I stand on for the traditional sort of area that Batman operates in, how young you really want to go, because he has to still have gravitas that he could run a company. But then, you know, many people are running companies by like 25, 28, so who am I to talk?
Yeah, I mean, now more than ever.
Okay, so I've got a few, because because interestingly though, Josh Brolin was approached, it was in consideration for the role when before Ben Affleck took it, but they felt like he would have been too old for Batman, and it would have probably been a proper Dark Knight Returns, well, 55-year-old Batman vibe, and they wanted someone slightly younger. Interestingly, Ryan Gosling was apparently linked as well, but I can't really see Gosling as Batman.
No.
Yeah.
He doesn't have the charm.
Because I've got two choices.
I mean, a lot of people would say he does, but...
Yeah.
I get what you mean, for sure. So,
my two choices. I would like to have gone for Lee Pace, who was the Elf King in the Hobbit films. Also, he was Ronan in Guardians of the Galaxy. But my main choice would be Oscar Isaac.
Oh, that's a good one.
Yeah. I can just see him doing it, though. That's the thing. I can just, because he's kind of got that, I feel like that physique and that kind of charm for the role, which I can see him getting, I can see him playing like a slightly bit weary Batman. Like he's a few years into the career, not career, where he's fought the Joker a few times and he's kind of a bit the more paranoid side of Batman we see.
I think Bob Iger. there's some good ideas. I think who else do a good job? Oscar Isaac's really interesting. I'm not sure if he's too, like, I think obviously he's an actor, so he has diversity and versatility, but I feel like Oscar Isaac has that, you know, he does sort of the kind of cold hard stare very well. So I think if he was Batman, that would be, you know, a much sterner take on it. Maybe more similar to, you know, maybe more similar to some of the ways that Christian Bale portrayed him as. But yeah, I think, who else comes to mind?
If they were young, I could see Ethan Hawke could have been a good Batman.
Ethan Hawke, yeah, that's a really good idea. Maggie Smith.
Like Jake Gyllenhaal was rumoured at one point as well. But I think, I don't know, I could see more as like a kind of like Riddler, to be honest.
Yeah, or I guess if he wasn't an Iron Man, then maybe Don Cheadle.
Well, that could be interesting in a portrayal. Yes. Yeah.
I could see that, he's got really good range.
Yeah.
I've got no choices. I think Ben Barnes could play Batman. He's got that chiseled jaw for it.
That's very true. That's a really good idea.
Like if he wasn't Daredevil, maybe Charlie Cox, but I could see him more as kind of like a scruffy lawyer figure that Matt Murdock is, rather than, you know, the Bruce Wayne, you know, the Bruce maybe Wayne sharp billionaire.
John Bernthal.
Okay, I can see that.
I guess he's already the Punisher.
Yeah, he is, but now though Matt may not continue that series, so we'll have to see. It's weird though. Like I can see David Tennant being a Riddler. I can see that.
Yeah. Ooh, that's really interesting. And yes, the last Riddler was Jim Carrey, wasn't it? Yeah.
Paul Dano is going to play the Riddler in the next one, which I think is perfect casting.
Oh, he'll be really good.
Yeah. I want to see if he get. I want to see Michael Sheen as like an Arkham, like Dr. Hugo Strange from like Arkham, as like a mad scientist.
Yeah, and Steve Buscemi as the Riddler would be really interesting. Oh.
Yeah.
I feel like, I don't know, I'd be interested to see someone like Jeff Bridges as Bruce Wayne's dad.
Really?
As Mr. Wayne, yeah.
Wow.
I'm not sure why that would.
I want to see Daniel Day-Lewis come out of retirement to play Alfred.
Yeah.
I want to see a method actor just giving all the cast cups of tea, like, no, Daniel, no, get on set. Like, oh, the kettle's boiled, no, get on set.
Playing it exactly how Michael Caine plays him.
Yeah. I think that would just be really interesting to see. I like the idea of Andy Serkis as a young Alfred though, because he's got that British charm to him, but he's also kind of got that still ex-army scruff about him though. You can tell like, oh, he's dead. You can probably put a bet on him in a pub that he's been in the army at some point.
It will be interesting to see a new version of Alfred. I think more so than Batman for me, because like. That is like the one and only Alfred to
Michael Caine.
Michael Caine.
Michael Caine.
I have seen like, you know, some of the animated Batman ones are beautiful and the voicing, but live action, he's the only one to me that's like a proper Alfred through and through well written character. So it'd be very interesting to reestablish that.
Yeah. I'm so excited to see an expand. I know the production has been delayed due to coronavirus, so it's gonna be another delay, understandably though. But I'm looking forward to seeing where Batman goes next, because we're going to have a few more Batman as well after Robert Pattinson as well. Now they're going down the whole multiverse route.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. And it's just, you know, like the, you know, what like what Batman is, what he represents, and, you know, his whole existence is so iconic that it's, yeah, I'm sure it will be timeless.
Like even just on tone and things, will be fun to see. So with what you guys were both saying earlier about Nolan setting a much darker tone to superheroes, how do you both feel about the fact that the Pattinson one has been described as it's going to be more gritty than anything you've seen in a superhero film.
I would like to see an R-rated Batman, because in some of the comics it can get proper messed up. Like in one of them, the Joker cuts his own face off. It's taken into custody, then he breaks into like the police, Gotham police, to take his face back. And just, I would like to see, because I feel like Batman, because look at his rogues gallery. You got like Scarecrow, Victor Zsasz, who like carves like a tally on his skin for every person he's killed. I feel, and like Black Mask, who Ewan McGregor played in the Harley Quinn film, I feel he's got the rogues gallery who you could properly explore, and you could proper then get into the dark psyche of Batman. Like, I'm not saying Batman should be dropping F-bombs every now and again, like, oh, effing hell, Alfred, what a day. But yeah, like, but I can just see, I would like to see a proper, I would like to see an R-rated Batman where it fully proper goes into the dark underworld of Gotham, because where we don't necessarily hold back. You see how depraved Arkham is and how poor the city really is at the end of the day.
I think from a commercial perspective, studios would be concerned that it would alienate or rather restrict their audience.
Yeah.
You know, if you're cutting out everyone under 18, then, you know, that would, you know, it cuts out a huge, you know, a surprisingly huge margin of Batman's or, you know, rather any superhero's audience. It would be really fascinating to see, though. You're right. I think it would, something like that would work as like a Netflix miniseries.
Yeah, that'd be interesting. Probably because, HBO Max though, so because of the
yeah, rights, yeah, exactly, yeah.
But HBO Max isn't coming out in the UK supposedly at this moment, so it might come on Now TV or Netflix because there's all the whole rights issues are going on. They will be interesting to see because because interesting, there's two more things that I kind of want to mention, because Todd Phillips did say he was be interested in doing a Batman in the Joker verse, so seeing a Batman come up against Arthur Fleck, to see, and that be, I think that could be interesting, depending how it's done though.
Yeah, and whether they'd keep any of that down to earth, like real worldliness that is very prevalent in Joker, and have it apply that to the very, you know, ultra tech savvy Batman. Yeah.
Because the thing is, though, there's going to be a Gotham PD series coming out to HBO Max as well about the set in the Robert Pattinson's universe, and Matt Reeves is actually going to be an executive producer on the show. Because I do think that I would love to see... I know we've had the Gotham series as well, but that was just about a young Jim Gordon mainly. But I do think there's definite scope to have like a series set in the Batman universe about like the crimes that Gotham police have to solve without Batman, or just about the general citizens of Gotham, you know, living in like a city which is very much a character as much as Batman, the Joker, so and so on.
Yeah, and the marketing is a Humans of Gotham page.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that would be really interesting. And I guess, you know, I guess because, you know, inevitably that takes away, sort of diverts us from the, you know, the main narrative. You know, Gotham has generally been seen as very one-dimensional.
Yeah, it's like neo-noir-esque, isn't it, in a way, isn't it?
Yeah, but if there was, you know, if it was a series, or at least a miniseries, then that could have the opportunity to delve into it in more detail, and add a few more dimensions to it. Yeah, that'd be really fascinating.
Yeah, I do think there's definite root scope to explore Batman, because it's a very rich universe full of characters beyond like the main villains and supporting cast. But which is why there's an Alfred mini, there's an Alfred series going on called Pennyworth at the moment, which is about a younger Alfred, which has got Paloma Faith in it, interestingly, as well. But I do think...
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Is she Alfred?
No, she's not Alfred, no. But I don't know.
Can you imagine?
I do feel with those films that I would love to have seen the Nolan ones. I wanted to see more of Cillian Murphy as Scarecrow.
Yes.
See, like, what made him become like that, in a way.
Yeah, yeah, that's... Yeah, and I guess... I mean, a whole series on the origins of Batman's villains would be really interesting.
Yeah. Because they're talking about doing a Joker-style film about Bane. Because Luthor and Bane apparently were favourites to get the Joker treatment.
Yeah, well, that's the thing, because I mean, I guess originally there wasn't, you know, a lot of people weren't that keen to see a Joker origin story, you know,
no.
Like citing that, you know, what makes a Joker so brilliant is his lack of origin. And then I guess we see it with Jack Nicholson's Joker, but in general, you know, his lack of a backstory makes him more the more fascinating and intriguing. But I would 100% be down to see a Bane origin story.
Yeah, I would as well. I would have seen the League of Shadows miniseries. There's a lot of room to play with those characters.
And I guess given the, you know, very... Actually, it's prevailed for quite some time, but, you know, now probably more than ever, you know, we have this very strong interest in villains.
Yeah.
You know, which I think would give it a lot of, you know, commercial attraction.
Because, like, Mark Strong, you know, in the actor, did say he loves playing the villain because you get a lot more to work with. You get to have a lot more to explore as an actor of how they became like that.
Yeah, and I'm sure it's a lot more fun as well.
Yeah, it is. You know, he's played so many iconic villains over his career.
Yeah.
So I think I can see, like, Ben Mendelsohn, Alan Rickman, they're all actors who are famous for playing the bad guy. Yeah. And I do think, in a way, you get... also, it's more interesting when you're known as a bad guy. When you actually play a hero, it's people more go, ooh. So, and like, it's more interesting to you to go against type that way, which is why I definitely really want to see Tom Hanks play a superhero villain. Like, maybe, like, an older Lex Luthor, or even Doc Ock, for example, in the Spider-Man films. I really feel like...
Yeah, he'd be a good Doc
Ock. He said in an interview as well, he wants to play a supervillain. And it's just because, obviously, he's seen as the ultimate nice guy. So it's why I love Road to Perdition so much, because he is, like, he's an actual gangster and he's not afraid to shoot someone with a Tommy gun. Yeah. I think it's why, so that's such a powerful film, because I think him playing against type was what I think what worked about that film in a way.
Well, I guess there was certain, you know, there's always that risk of going against type or not. In the sense that Hugh Grant has starred in, you know, these, like, you know, a couple of dark thrillers before, which have been reviewed very negatively. But then in Cloud Atlas, you know, there's, albeit a very small role, but in one of the narratives, he plays a cannibal warlord.
Wow.
You know, which is the least, you know, least expected Hugh Grant role possible.
Yeah, and like even in Guy Ritchie's The Gentleman, he's a foul-mouthed paparazzi figure who's got criminal dealings.
So yeah, but and that's the thing, but then because those characters are villains, so, you know, it's, you know, I guess being a villain often you know comes with the expectation that you're playing a caricature of some sort, you know, sometimes it doesn't necessarily need depth, but it needs to be fun and it needs to be imaginative, and you know, they're often the most engaging parts of the film.
You know, because it's like when you see, like, in a film, like, there's an actor who plays the hero, but it turns out it was a twist, and, oh, they're the villain, that adds a lot more to the twist in a way. That, oh, sure. It's actually them the whole time. So,
ooh, this changes everything.
And I do find it interesting, like, to see actors, like, play for roles that you don't think they're going to do it, but then they smash it out of the ballpark.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Saying that, though, I think in the 80s, Tom Hanks would have been a brilliant Flash. I think I just see him as like a big era Tom Hanks, as like just Barry Allen Flash just running around. You know, I think that would have been really good, but alas.
Yeah, that's a really good idea. I can see Ryan Gosling as a good Flash, to be fair.
Yeah, I can see him as a Flash, weirdly. Yeah. I can see him, yeah, because he's got that awkwardness that Barry Allen has, which I think I would... you know, and that kind of loner appeal as well, but we'll see. We'll see if he gets it, but we never know.
Yeah, we'll see. Were there any other points that either of you were keen to make?
Not that I can think of. No, I think we've covered everything.
I think we covered the whole Batman verse.
Yeah.
Kat, any further points or anything you'd like to leave us with? Or leave our audience with to consider?
No.
Jack, any final
thoughts? No, I can't think, you know. Like, in a way, my favourite Batman, I think, at the moment is Christian Bale. I do think Ben Affleck could have been great if, in a way, if he had better material. Because I think he's got that world awareness that Bruce Wayne has, while also having that kind of charm. But... I'm really interested to see who Robert Pattinson and whoever replaces him eventually, what they all bring to the role, though. And I think it's important to remember each Batman is of its time and it's very different. I think
true.
It's important to remember that in the role.
Context dependent. Yeah, and depending on who the director draws inspiration from, you know, both thematically and visually, and, you know, what they're interested in from a technical perspective. You know, the in terms of cinematography and color grazing and even editing. You know, it all plays a huge role in, you know, what ultimately shapes the universe, you know, what can make Gotham, you know, more three-dimensional, like we were discussing earlier. So, yeah, there's a lot to play with, and, you know, nowadays Batman has more influences to draw from than ever before. So, yeah, we'll see what Paddington's Batman looks like, and you know whether you know the broader DC universe will remain dark and gritty, or whether it will, you know, maybe take more of a Marvel approach, or you know, assume a whole new identity of its own at some point down the line. For sure. Thank you so much for listening.
Thank you for listening.
If you have any further thoughts on the legacy of Nolan's Batman trilogy, then please feel free to tweet us at Tom Hanks Defense, Defense with a C, as we like to point out sometimes. So yeah, please feel free to tweet us, and we'll be more than happy to answer any questions.
Yeah,
and we'd love to hear your thoughts. So yeah, Kat, thank you for being a magnificent guest as always.
Thanks for letting me back on. I'm surprised you haven't banned me yet.
Our absolute pleasure. And we'll be back next time with more intriguing thoughts, ideas, and I'm sure many more mystery pitches.
Okay, brilliant. Yes, looking forward to them.
Thank you so much. Have a wonderful day.
Take care, sirs. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Tom Hanks Defense Force. Find us and join the conversation on Twitter and Facebook.